This episode is brought to you by Tailwind Nutrition. You know, it's even though it's winter, you still need to hydrate, Don.
You know, that's something that can fool you, because in the heat, you know, you need to start drinking, but you still require nutrients even in the cold.
And in the really cold, if you continue to shake that bottle, it won't freeze on you.
Is that if you run fast enough, Scott?
We have Travis Macy on the line again. He's a coach and a great runner that we've met, and he has a lot of good golden nuggets of information in his brain. We welcome him back to Tailwind Tip
of the Trail.
Of the Trail.
Let's say it like we own it, Scott. The Tailwind Tip of the Trail. Welcome, Travis.
Yeah, guys. Thanks a lot. Always good to be here with you and the listeners.
Hey, you told us recently that you learned something. What did you learn recently?
Well, you know, what I learned recently is some information about my own exercise metabolism. So what I did is I ran on a treadmill. My test was about 45 minutes long. I was breathing into a machine that tested the gases that I expelled out of my mouth. And what's amazing is this machine, based on the composition of the gases that you exhale, it can tell you what you're burning for fuel at that point. And most importantly, you know, at this given point of this test, am I burning carbohydrate? Am I burning fat? You know, what is the ratio of those two fuel sources? And the way this test works, you know, again, you're kind of running at an increasing effort. And for most people, you start out pretty easy and you're burning almost all fat, you know, maybe 95% fat and then 5% carbohydrate. And as you go harder and harder, it becomes more carbohydrate burning and less fat. And you may eventually get to a point called the crossover point, where at that point you're burning 50% fat and 50% carbohydrate. And then if you keep going, you'd be burning more and more carbohydrate and less fat. This test is super valuable. I did it in Boulder, Colorado with Energy Performance. There's a bunch of other companies and groups, you know, around the country that do it. And incredibly helpful data that I can use to tweak my training and then also to tweak my nutrition in a race. Because now I know, okay, at a given heart rate, how many calories per hour do I need of carbohydrate in order to keep moving at that heart rate? So it's really cutting edge stuff. It's called the exercise metabolism test, and highly recommended, you know, maybe $200 to $400. And I think it's a worthwhile investment.
Hey, you know, I would like to do a podcast on that, Scott. I know you have a question coming up, but I think we could really expand on that, because what I would like to get into would require more time than we have right at the beginning of this podcast. And that is, how do you use this, and how does it make you a better runner, and how does it make your training change, and how do you recheck later to make sure things are going right? I have a lot of questions in that area, and if you're ready for that, let's schedule that and do that.
Yeah, I could do it, or, you know, I have other people in mind, but yeah, it's training, it's nutrition, lots of applications. I'm highly recommending it to the athletes I coach.
Cool.
One thing that you do need when you're out to training and when you're racing is some good nutrition, and Tailwind Nutrition is good nutrition. It also has some electrolytes that you need to get back that hydration.
Hey, Travis, when you're doing that test, are you able to drink any of this Tailwind, or you just have to drink it before you start the test?
Well, you have to do the test fasted. So in other words, no calories, you know, after dinner the night before. So you can't do it before, you can't do it during, because this thing is literally hooked in your mouth. And, but yeah, you can have it after. So,
awesome.
Yeah, I got a little Tailwind later in the day, and then next day I went ski mountaineering and had some more. So
Travis Macy, as always, love the knowledge and look forward to discussing this further, because we all look to improve and want to become better runners. And we need to use tools like this to help us reach our potential.
Sounds great, guys.
Go to tailwindnutrition.com, or you can go to our webpage, Trail Runner Nation, and go over to the partners page and link on over.
Health IQ, the leader on the podium, Scott, when it comes to life insurance. Runners are healthier. There's no doubt about it. Swimmers are healthier. Kayaking people are healthier. People that are active are healthier.
Yeah. Quilters should not be paying the same amount of money for life insurance.
No, couch potatoes should not be. But a quilter might be very active, Scott.
They could be on a treadmill quilting.
That's true.
It is. that science has proven that if you're active, whether you're running or biking or whatever, if you're active, you're going to live longer and healthier. So if you're buying life insurance, you want to get the lowest rate that you can get for the best coverage. Health IQ does that for you. They pair A-rated insurance companies with healthy people.
That's a smart plan.
It is.
And that's Health IQ.
Go to healthiq.com/TRN.
Ultra Running Magazine, full of ultra running stuff. You know, some magazines you pick up and you kind of thumb through it till you find some that you're interested in. In this thing, you're interested in every single page.
If you are an ultra runner and you don't have a subscription to Ultra Running Magazine,
then you're not an ultra runner.
You're a road runner.
You're a road runner. You have dirt on your legs, but you're still a road runner. You need to get the magazine.
And you can get $20 off an annual subscription if you follow the link on our partners page.
Hey, Scott, I know you're here at the store. Things are busy. Things are crazy. But did you hear the 33 Shake winners are get ready to be posted?
We have this week's 33 Shake winners. They will be posted on the podcast description. So the three of you that actually read the podcast description, you can find out if you're a winner. The way that you become a winner is to post a video, a photo, get creative, post that to social media and tag it, hashtag Fueled by 33 Shake and hashtag Inspired by TRN, and we randomly pick winners.
Hey, sir, yes, the Aftershock headset's right over here, and the arm sleeves you're looking for right next to it. Yes, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
Yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warren. Today we are in Studio G after coming over from the store.
We left the store. We're going to record a podcast. We're meeting Tim.
We closed down for lunch.
and a long run. And we went over to AJW's tap room because he was supposed to be on the podcast.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we found him face down.
Today was Friday Growler Day.
Right.
And he, I guess, partook.
Well,
a little too heavy.
All of the vendors come by and try to win his favor. And they bring him samples. And sometimes he overindulges.
So he's on the floor in the tap room.
Which is fine. We'll leave him there. We'll check on him later. But we'd like to welcome Tim Tweetmeyer. And it is our honor and pleasure. A local runner, but of international people know him all over the world. So we're happy that he's here.
He's won a small race called Western States 5 times.
And probably one of the things that impresses me most, and I don't think anybody can ever touch it just logistically, is 25 finishes under 24 hours. And he could have had more had he decided to take more of those entry spots, but he stepped back and let others enjoy it.
And 15 of those top five?
Wow. Impressive.
Tim's a humble guy. He's just not mouthing anything. He's just kind of nodding his head. Yeah.
What I think is he's in a little shock with AJW's appearance on the behind the bar, and I think that's what really has his tongue.
It's probably not the first time you found him on the floor at the tap room.
No. Have you found him that way before? You meet there at the tap room for a run. You guys all show up, and is this something he does frequently?
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A little bit of drool coming out one side of the mouth.
Well, one of the things that what we'd like to have a podcast today about is back to basics. You know, things change a lot.
It's the beginning of the year. People are reassessing their training. And
our sports evolved.
It has.
And so luckily, when we opened our store, when we did the renovation, we went to the back and we found this machine of some kind. We weren't really sure what it was.
The store, by the way, is on the historic registry.
Yes.
It's an old store. We had to do some renovation.
2 doors down from the tap room and across the street from the Studio G, which we are now. And when we went to renovate the store, we found this large machine of some kind. Turns out...
I thought it was a safe.
It wasn't a safe, but we got into it and found out it was a time machine. AJW is the only one who knows how to run it, so we're going to just kind of wing it today. And we're all stepping into it, and we're winding it up, and we're going to transport ourselves back to 1988. Tim, were you running in 88?
Yep.
Yeah.
Running
in
88.
So you've seen many things change and evolve since that time, mm-hmm. and we kind of want to talk about some of those. We're going to get into that, but I have a couple of questions I have for Tim before we get started
yeah,
on
yeah.
our journey.
Oh, yeah. Tim, got to get to know Tim.
Well, you have to run fast to get to know Tim. Tim, were you the founder of the ice cream run?
Yeah, that was that kind of. I didn't really expect that to kind of go where it went, but it's become a kind of a yearly pilgrimage now.
Tell us about the ice cream run.
Well, you know, it happens once a year, usually several weeks before Western States, for those that are trying to, you know, dial in their training, their final, like, really grueling long run. And it starts at the cul-de-sac above Cal 2, and it's a mile to the aid station, and then it's 24 miles up the course to the swinging bridge, turn around and come back. But when you get to Forest Hill, the rule is you have to have at least one ice cream sandwich. And there's some debate about how much Mountain Dew you need to drink, but somewhere between 16 and 20 ounces. And that's kind of just loading the boiler for the for the run to Cal 2. And the goal is, you know, to be a finisher, you have to finish in 1:15 to get to Cal 2 in 1:15. So its idea is to get really tired during the run, going through all the stuff you do during the race. And then when you get to the good running, you got to be able to run, right? There's probably no sweeter single track than Forest Hill to Cal 2, right?
It is a beautiful downhill.
And so the idea there is to, like, see what it's like, going to be feel like on race day. And, you know, if you make it in 1:15, you're a finisher. And if you don't, we don't know about you. you're off the course. Oh, and there's one other rule, and it's too bad Andy isn't here, because he could testify. If you get sick, if you blow along the way, you're DQ'd immediately. Yeah, might as well just, you're out. So
I think I've seen a photo of AJW blowing.
Well, that's always part of the good social media bang when you get some of that attention.
So that was one that kind of developed over the years, training for Western States, thinking, you know, you got to go farther runs. And how do you do that when you're crewing for yourself and there's not a lot of facilities out there? You know, they've got some pumps and wells out there we can use. And it just got turned into, like, this is the, you know, if you got 50 miles, you need a 50-mile training run, you got to do it by yourself. This is one you could do and self-serve. Then when you get to Forest Hill, you know, just, I don't know how it got started, but that was the goal.
I have an idea. Let's have an ice cream sandwich and a Mountain Dew. Yeah. That sounds like a smart thing to do.
See how fast we can go to Cal, too. I had done it last year for the first time for several years, because I ran my last Western States in 2006 and hadn't been, you know, participating the last few years. I forgot how hard you got to go in order. I was like, holy moly, man, I got to put the gas on.
Did you ever blow?
No.
You have
an iron
stomach.
No, that's part of the deal, you know. That's what you're trying to galvanize the stomach on that run to make sure that, you know, nothing happens late in the race.
So, I mean, some metabolic training as well as some turnover with the legs.
Yeah, I
love it.
I'm surprised they haven't made a ice cream sandwich Mountain Dew goo flavor yet.
There used to be a store in downtown Forest Hill, and it had this wooden bench in front of it and a water spigot right next to it.
Yeah,
so you got there, and it's like, okay, I'm going to take a break here, sit down, you know, collect myself. And then I said, well, I better go in and get something to eat, because it's a long way to Cal 2, and it's whatever you carried from the car, you know, 10 hours ago.
Right.
And so you just kind of go in there, what tastes good? Ice cream sandwich and a Mountain Dew. That's perfect.
That store was a staple. That hose bib and that store was truly an aid station.
Yeah, I still miss it.
Yeah, yeah. So another thing I wanted to catch up on is the wintertime crossing of Western States. I remember you, Dean Karnazes. Who else was on that?
Bill Finkbeiner. Right?
Yeah, Bill Finkbeiner. Yeah.
So tell us about that, and how long ago was it?
It was 2004.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it was kind of got off the ground. I had read this article about one of the guys that's buried in the graveyard at Last Chance. So you've probably never seen it, because you're running through there, you're not paying attention. But, you know, there's those old, you know, bark strippers and logging things out there.
Yeah.
But there's an old graveyard out there, and there's a few guys that are still there. And one of the guys was someone that had made the trek over the Sierras during, you know, the winter time, and made it to Last Chance and then expired there. And it was this very, it was a letter that he'd written about their travails of trying to get to Last Chance several days, you know. And, you know, getting stuck and then having to backtrack, and then their mule ran off, and all these you know, all these things that tend to just all go wrong at the same time. And then they made it to Last Chance, and one guy went on and actually continued and then ended up going, becoming a doctor or something famous somewhere else. But I said, wow, that's an interesting story. But I read that and I said, well, I wonder what it would be like to go over the Sierras in the middle of the winter. I mean, we do it in the hottest part of the summer,
right?
Seems like, anyway. And so it's a completely different experience,
and sometimes there's snow then.
So which was harder, in the heat and the, you know, the baking conditions of the canyon, or the freezing conditions?
Well, both of them have their challenges. I think we weren't racing on the snow one, so we were really, it was more of a joyride. So that was definitely easier. But what was interesting there is, you know, the minute it got dark, it got cold, really cold. Mm. You couldn't stop running without getting cold. So you almost had to keep moving. Every time we'd stop to meet our crew, we had somebody chasing us with snowmobiles and food. If we stopped, we had to put jackets and hoods on and everything because you immediately you stopped running, you got cold, and you wanted to keep going. So they were very short stops.
So you weren't on skis? Were you snowshoes?
We snowshoed from Squaw Valley till about where the Deadwood Road is, and then from there the rest of the way. We ran with shoes.
I think I read an article on that in Auburn Journal, the local paper that covered it, and they said something about In-N-Out Burgers at Michigan Bluff.
Yeah, somebody did us a solid on that, just toted out some In-N-Out Burgers out to Michigan Bluff. And by that time, it was, you know, 10 or 11 at night, I want to say, and we'd started at 5 in the morning at Squaw, so, you know, we didn't get to Robinson Flat until about 4:30. The sun was just starting to go down. That gives you how slow it is going through the snow. Right. And we used the Soda Springs Road rather than going through Duncan because that was closed at the time due to the star fire. So, but yeah, it's actually a really pretty day. You're in snow, and we had a bluebird day, so we were out there with just a long sleeve shirt and a pair of tights, and it was perfectly comfortable.
Now, it would take someone like yourself that has been on that trail 25 times plus all the maintenance and training you've done on to really know your way around. That would be dangerous for someone that wasn't familiar with the tops of the trees.
Yeah, it's really difficult navigating once the sun goes down and everything's either black or snow. And so even if you're on a road, sometimes it's really difficult even to navigate, even though you know there's a road below you somewhere. Yeah. If you get into a bunch of trees that aren't that far apart, there were a couple times where we were all cuddled together.
Were you using some kind of a GPS?
I had one with us. We had maps and we had a GPS.
But did you have to use them?
There was nothing to follow. Yeah. I mean, particularly around Deadwood and that where you have roads coming on and off and there's a lot of trees. And by that point, it was pitch black. And so you really don't have much perspective other than the 100 feet you can see from your headlamp. So, yeah, it was a trick.
Yeah, that sounds good. Has anybody else done it since? Do you know?
Not that I know
they
of.
They haven't called
but,
you.
Know,
it, yeah, they will.
I'd like to do it again sometime.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, one of these days, just get back out there. Well,
there's a lot of snow up there this year. It would be could be a fun trip.
Mm-hmm.
Another item I'd like to catch up on is the cap-to-cap run. Mm-hmm. What was the cap-to-cap run?
Well, you know, I did that one
explain
from Carson
what it is.
City.
Yeah.
Carson City, the capital of Nevada, to Sacramento, the capital of California. And, you know, there used to be a horse ride, a four-day horse ride that went that distance, and it was 450-mile days. You know, it went from, like, you know, Carson City to Squaw, and then Squaw to, let's say, Deadwood to Auburn, then Auburn to Sac. And, you know, they rested every day and camped out or, you know, whatever they did, and then rode the next day. And I said, well, you know, I don't necessarily want to take that long. I'll just try to do it all in one. And it was kind of one of those things where we were trying to get the trail kind of designated as National Historic and Scenic Trail. And so kind of it was kind of bring some visibility around that. But I figure, hey, part of the fun of that is just exploring the trails and trying to connect everything up. How do you get from Carson City to Squaw without being on the road? And how do you get, you know, some of those places, you know, once you're below Auburn, there's a lot of choices along the way. I didn't stay on the Western States Trail 100% of the time, but, you know, what's the most efficient way to get through there, using as much trail as you can, plus having access to things like water and food and crew and that.
So it was 200 miles?
It's a little under 200 miles. Okay. The way I went, I probably cut a little corner here or there, but yeah, it's in the range somewhere between 170 and 190 miles in there somewhere.
So you beat Candace Burt, the race director, putting all these 200s. You put one together some time ago. What year was that, did you say? Did you already mention
that? That was 2008, I want to say. Yeah. You know, the interesting part about that is, you think, you know, you'd be on roads a fair amount of the time, and you know, there's almost if once you get to, you know, there's almost no road if you know where you're going from Carson City to Auburn, and then Auburn to Folsom's no road, and then even once you get to Folsom, if you stay on the side of the bike trail and use the horse trails and whatnot, you can almost go all the way to Sac State, which is only a couple 3-4 miles from the capital, maybe, on dirt.
Wow.
You know, 100 and how many miles going straight, you know, east to west, and you're pretty much never on the pavement.
And what time of year was this? Not in the winter.
You know, I started. That was the year they had the big fire at Western States, and I'd planned to do it over 4th of July, I want to say, because I wanted the extra day, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it was too smoky. I ran from Carson to Tahoe Meadows up near Incline, and it was so smoky. It was just ridiculous. So we shut it down, and then I came back a few weeks later and did it when the smoke had cleared. So that was the year we canceled the run and the ride, and the ride was after 4th of July. It was like the middle of July. That fire was going for quite a long time, so all the activities kind of got turned around there.
Now, what's impressive about this is the time. Don was telling me this at one point, that you, a crazy fast time going from capital to capital. What did you finish the 170-ish miles?
I'd have to do the math. I understood there would be no math.
Don's done the math. No, you do the math?
No, it's like 43 and a half hours, I want to say, something like that.
Wow.
So it's, yeah, I started about 5 in the morning, 4:30, and then finished, I want to say, about 11 o'clock at the Capitol in SAC.
Well, yeah. I know how long it takes to run 200 miles, and I kind of doubled that 43-hour thing. That's very fast, Tim.
That was when I was young.
It was a few years ago. Still young. You're still capable. He could still be putting those sub-24 buckles on at Western States. What I remember, though, to your point, Scott, was because I had to read about that one, too, because your stuff gets in the local papers when you do these runs like this, and you came in at a sub-8-minute pace or an 8-minute-mile pace at the very end. That's some turnover after all of those miles on your leg.
He was hungry. He had to get to the restaurant.
It was funny. I think we ended up doing it on the Labor Day weekend, now that I recall. And so we had the extra holiday again. I was trying to, you know, you got work and family obligations. And as we were coming in Sunday night, because I think I started, like, say, 4:30 Saturday and Sunday, all of the frat houses and sororities were out at Sac State, you know, having parties. They were yelling at us because, I mean, it's 11 o'clock at night. You don't expect to see anybody out in the Capitol. Everybody should be, you know, back to bed. But since it was a holiday, everybody was out hooting and hollering. So that made it a little more fun, got us going a little bit. Yeah.
Before we step into the time machine, because it's going to be a gamble. I don't know if we're going to end up in 1988 or 1888. It's a little fuzzy to me on that one digit. And if it's 1888, we're all going to be in the dark there. But it makes it sound like Tim's been around forever, but he started young. You started ultra running at a pretty young age.
Yeah, I was probably 20, 21.
How did you get? Yeah. How did you enter into this crazy situation?
Well, it's pretty funny. I my sister had started running. I started jogging a little bit. You know, that you could use the word jogging.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's quite as evil as it is now. Are you a runner or a jogger?
Yeah.
I lived in Redwood City, which isn't too far from Woodside, and I worked at this country club as a caddy. And right across the street was this track for this high school, and I started reading Runner's World, which was really the only publication, and that's about the extent of it at that time. And I saw this note about this 24-hour run at this track, and I was like, wow, I got to see this. this is really interesting. Are these guys going to run, you know, San Francisco and then come back, or are they going to go around the track or what?
Yeah.
And so I did my little caddying work in the morning on Saturday and walked over there and watched, and I was just so fascinated by watching these guys go around in circles. You'd think it would be really super boring, you know?
Yeah.
No, the same thing every 2 minutes, three minutes.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the great, you know, all-time greats in ultra running were there, so I was able to watch it. And Don Choi, you know, mailman from San Francisco, he had a lot of the 24-hour records early in ultra running. Dick Collins, Ruth Anderson, you know, these kind of names where you're like, wow, those are like the pillars of the early races and running here. You know, you'd see Dick at every race you went to in the 80s. And, you know, Ruth was, you know, the original queen of ultra running in the West Coast and great woman. Both of those folks from the Bay Area, you just got to see them at so many events and look forward to seeing them because they were part of the fabric of ultra running. So, you know, it's like, hey, those are pretty good people. Maybe I should join that crowd. So the next year they had the same race and I went and ran my Western States qualifier when I was still in college you know, just go out there and do 50 miles on the track. And so that's what I did. And, you know, again, wanted to be part of that group.
So did you ever, you didn't start with a 5K, 10K. You just said, I want to go 24 hours.
Well, I kind of went, you know, at that time, the best way to do it was to get the mileage was just to, there were a lot of marathons then. That was right after the Frank Shorter marathons everywhere, which you could use those as the training run. So I started doing a fair amount of marathon running on the road. But, you know, there was something about that clicked when I saw those people running and they were enjoying it. And there was no kind of bravado or check out how far I'm going.
Right.
It was just, you know, we're out here doing our thing and, you know, we're enjoying it and have a lot of camaraderie. So I was like, hey, that looked like, okay, I could probably try that. And then once I did it, it was like, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe going slow a really long time works. You know, never have to go fast. You just never slow down.
You know, when the bug bit me the hardest and when I was definitely, you know, came down with this condition, it was volunteering at the aid station at mile 78 at Western States. Mm-hmm. So it's the river crossing. And a guy came up and I was working the medical part where you're weighing the people in. Mm-hmm. And I was holding him by the arm because he couldn't stand up and he smelled like he'd been out all day. And I thought, oh, I want to do that. I don't know why. That just appealed to me. And that was the hook. It was, I'm holding him up, and his legs are shaking, and he still has 22 miles to go, and I thought, ooh, I want a piece of that.
Yeah, this looks like fun.
Yeah. All right, we ready to step into this machine?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I imagine there'll be some
Is there a doorknob on this thing?
No, it's a crank, okay? And we
That's an old crank. Has gears.
We'll step out of this time machine, and it looks very much like 1988, because it's not 1888. There aren't horses and carriages around. I think we're safe, guys.
Mullets are abound.
Yeah, and I'm listening to some...
Duran Duran.
Duran Duran. Very good.
Nice.
On your Walkman.
That's right. Let's start with that. Yeah. We're going to kind of talk about some changes from today, 2017 and 1988. We didn't have iPods. We didn't have wireless headsets, but we still liked our music. Tim, I heard you ran with an AM radio.
Yeah, I've run with just about everything. I think I still had a cassette player when I was in '88. You know, your favorite hit, so you could, you know, take your mind off of how hard it was to get.
You
to
made
the
your
Canyons.
Own mixes, did you? Yeah.
Either that, or every once in a while, I'd AM radio, I'd be going through a Devil's Thumb with the Giants game on. You guys need a score update? I've got it.
Could you actually get AM radio through that area?
In places, yeah, it's something to keep your mind off how long you're out there.
Yeah, I guess back then, I'm trying to remember. They didn't have earbuds.
They were starting to come in then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I know that those things are cumbersome, heavy. They're not light. Today we're in the smallest and the lightest of objects, but you're fully committed when you have a cassette player.
Yeah. You know, even on when I did the run on the track, my first one, I had a transistor radio in the middle of the night. It's like there was no one out there with me. I'm going to listen to something. Same thing.
So let's talk about just some of the things like hydration packs and bottles. And maybe you can put, if there's truth to this. I remember talking to Dana Gard, and you know that name, and he's been part of this local community, about carrying mustard bottles and
Jemima syrup bottles.
Yes. Log cabins.
Any true to that?
Yeah, that was because there weren't any. I mean, and you know, you just found something that would work for you, that was comfortable enough to run with in your hand. It seems like now there's kind of more of two fronts. There's the people that love to carry water in their hands, and the ones that hate to carry water in their hands. Yeah, so they've got the hydration pack, and you know, pick what you like. But that was really all there was. And you know, Norm and those guys with what he got involved in Western States created the Western States 100 pack or whatever that was called. And then there was a couple other smaller ones, but there were no pack companies. There were no hydration companies. It was all just kind of roll your own and find something that worked. Yeah.
So you know, the soft squeeze mustard bottles that you could squirt the fluid right in your mouth, people really carried those.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the reasons why it was a little more difficult to finish in those days, because there just wasn't all these nice, really, you know, convenient tools to use to get from aid station or to go for so far without, you know, either drinking out of the creeks or, you know, designing your own bottle. And it was certainly not as comfortable and useful as the stuff that we have today.
Has the trail changed that much? Has it become? I've heard the trail's faster than it's ever been because it's been groomed. And is it harder now? And I know that you're going to have to say, well, there's been years that we've changed, you know, locations based on snow years and fires. So with put that aside, just overall in the areas that don't change, has it become?
No, I think
faster?
The trail's pretty much the same as it is. I mean, you know, sections come and go, and you know, between fires and rains like we've had recently here, you know, it gets affected one way or the other, but. You know, it's still 100 miles, and, you know, on a normal year, we have a little bit of snow, a little bit of heat, you know, the things that, you know, kind of that mix of challenges that make it interesting. So,
You know, today you look, and there's so many choices of what can go in your water bottles or your hydration pack. What did you put in yours back in 1988?
You know, for most of the runners on the trail, I mean, it was really just water. At the aid station, sometimes there were, you know, you'd have ERG Gukinade, that was like the replacement drink at the time. I don't think Gatorade had quite come along or become pervasive in endurance events at the time. And so it was like water. And then a lot of times somebody do like either lemonade or iced tea or something that you might find at a picnic and put out there. What people might like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, they had to find something good to drink because the Gukinade stuff really tasted terrible.
And
you know, you didn't really want to drink that because not only did it taste like you're thinking, oh, man, that's probably just make me sick. All I need is something that tastes really awful, you know, at mile, you know, 65. And then you just, you know, a small sampling. There might be a pile of potato chips and some Oreos, maybe some fresh fruit. Depending on the aid station, you know, a lot of times the aid station captain would spice it up with something a little more interesting, maybe roll in some pizza or, you know, some sandwiches and peanut butter and jelly. But nothing like it is today where there's, you know, a wild assortment of things to eat and drink and supplements and everything else that comes along.
You know, some of the aid stations I've seen, you know, especially, you know, up at Tahoe 200, the runner could come in and put in an order. They could say, I want to have a ham and turkey on rye with some avocado, and they would make whatever you want.
We didn't.
There was a menu.
There's more time to finish that race than than.
Well, you had time to sit down and eat that sandwich too.
Part of that is you're going to be on the trail for another 3 hours before the next aid station. Probably, so you had to take a meal with you to get to the next one.
Or 8 hours. Some of those, some of those sections take quite a ways. There's 20 miles between stations and up and over climbing. So there's some time in there, and especially if it's nighttime.
Yeah.
Well, which makes, you know, from a sports standpoint, I think sometimes that's why it might be a little more challenging back in the 80s, only because you didn't have all these tools at your disposal to make things, I don't want to say easier, but, you know, to kind of tune your performance. And plus, you know, additional aid stations, it seems like there's been things added there. And, you know, you got the supplement stuff, you know, that's kind of being debated now whether that's necessary or not. But, you know, now there's so many choices. If you can't find anything you like, then you know, you're probably at the wrong event.
Gukinade, where did you pick that up? Was it, you know, passed around the local community, or did you go down
to... go to the grocery store and buy Gukinade.
You know, the only place you could get it would be one of the specialty running stores. You couldn't get it at anywhere else, right?
Did Gukinade go out of business? Did they get bought up by somebody? I'm going to have to do some research on that.
They might have got to fold it in,
So one thing that I've been noticing is a cool watch that you have on. Sun 2, I think, is what you have on. Is that...
it's a Garmin Fenix 3.
Oh, it's a Garmin. It's a Garmin. Explain to us about how that has changed. I mean, what did you use in 88? Just a Timex Ironman watch?
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing about ultra runs. You don't really need that nice of watch. You're out there for so long, man. Sundial would work. But, you know, that was it. I mean, that's what's funny about even some like Western States where you didn't have any idea really how far things were. That's why the course got adapted over the years, is because we realized it wasn't as far as we were saying it was. You know, say it's 100 miler and you found out it was only, you know, 91.3 or something. And like, hey, wait, here's false advertising here. I wanted the full money here. So, but yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. Another tool, you know, when you think about what's available now where you can see how fast you're going, how far you're going, how maybe even how far it is to the next aid station. In the other days, you know, you didn't know that. Or interesting, you know, if you wanted to go train on the trail, there may not be enough information for you to really figure out which way to go.
Right.
You know, you needed a native guide if you wanted to go and train on a course that was, you know, whether you're talking, you know, Western States or any other 100 miler, those weren't normally marked other than weekend of the race. So if you didn't have somebody that knew how to, you know, find their way in the backcountry and stay on the trail, you were out of luck.
You know, I remember talking to Sally McCray when she was training for her, I think it was her first Western States. She had an app on her phone, I think it was called RunGo.
Yes, right.
That that talks to you and tells you if you're off course. Oh, turn left at the next. And I that just blows my mind. I want to ask you this, Tim. Do you think that your training, just talking about the watch and the computer that's on your wrist, has that helped you become a better athlete?
I probably haven't used it as much as what other people have done because it came along, you know, a little bit later than when I was kind of in the prime window. But for me, I've always kind of done it a little more on feel. There were times where I used my watch to measure things and see how fast I was going. There were certain workouts that you knew it should take you a certain amount of time. But as far as using all the bells and whistles and heart rates and analysis and all that, no, I haven't ever gotten into that.
Yeah, there's stuff that I look at when I pop open the screen and it's, how much time you spend in the air and your stride length and
your cadence.
I mean, there's so much information out there, and frankly, I don't know how to use it.
It might be overwhelming too. I wanted to just get too deep into it, and you know, rather than working out, you're over there analyzing numbers all day.
Exactly.
I brought up Dana Gard earlier, but that's been a mentor for me out there, and one of the things that he knew and practiced and shared was, from this rock to that tree, it is, you know, 7 miles. I mean, he knew everything by landmark, by, you know, the water place for the horse from that
trough.
Spot, the trough. Yeah. So he had everything dialed in by landmarks.
Well, you know, you also told me that he also had it dialed in by time. Mm-hmm. He knew that from here to here, it should take you 43 minutes to make this climb from the creek up to the top is going to take you 35 minutes.
Or Sandy Bottom that section is going to be 21 minutes or whatever it
was. That's amazing to me.
And I know people that name the landmarks by time, right? So I was running with somebody one day, and we were kind of headed out towards Auburn Lake Trail. I was like, well, that's 10-minute rock. What?
Oh, wow.
10-minute rock.
What does that mean? Well, when you hit this rock, on a normal day, it's 10 minutes to the aid station. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Wow.
Or 7-minute hill at Cal 3. Wow. You know, you get out off the trail, you're onto the road, and it's 7-minute hill. Oh, that's 7 minutes from time you hit that road till you get to the aid station. I'm like, well, it's good to know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I often wonder if we become too dependent on these watches to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, or if people still measure time by that. I don't know.
I like it. Hey, let's talk about Body Glide or some of these anti-chafing.
Squirrel Nut Butter.
Which I believe is the very best on the market right now, Squirrel Nut Butter. Have you used that?
Oh, yeah.
That's good stuff.
Carry it every day when I'm running in the summer.
You put a pinch between your cheek and gum, and it'll keep
no,
you.
No, not it's, that type
it's,
of Squirrel Nut
it's,
Butter.
It's the good it's the good fat.
No, that's I think that one of the things that can really ruin a run is chafage. I mean, that's some painful stuff, and you can really avoid it with the right type of product. What did you guys use in 1988?
And there's, you know, if you use Vaseline, it's so lightweight that, you know, it would melt. That wasn't, you know, you try it.
The viscosity.
Might work for, it might work for an hour. It doesn't really do you much good on the events we do.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that I remember that I got from a Gordy tip way back when was bag balm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right,
I mean, I had that because it's really thick. And, you know, it lasts a lot longer, and you just got to make sure you don't get any rocks or dirt in it. It ruins the whole party. But, you know, that and, you know, there were some other things in other sports I picked up along the way. There was a product that one of my high school coaches used called Skin Lube, and it's made by one of the sports product companies, and it's just a really – it has a lot of lanolin in it,
yeah.
And so it's not necessarily petroleum, so the same as having something like a Vaseline or that.
Yeah.
And that seemed to work pretty good too, but I think everybody was trying whatever they could because, you know, same thing. Back in the day, there weren't any, like, tights and shorts and those kind of things that, in a way, now help us not to chafe other than with these other products that are available. So that's become, you know, another thing that almost everybody – that's in a longer event now is wearing some kind of short tights or something that helps that as well, right? Keeps things from getting into trouble.
I think I still have a jar of bag balm
on
my shelf.
Yeah. Those little green cans are awesome.
Right, yeah. Tim says it lasts a long time. I've had mine 20 years. It does last a long time. So I guess, you know, we're in the time machine, I'm going to take a pause for a second. How about poles? You know, I've recently ran a race and used poles, and, man, they feel like you're cheating. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that, you know, Europe is big on poles, and here in the United States there's a lot of races, like Western States, for instance, that are poleless?
Mm. You know, if you look at a lot of the European races, I've been over to UTMB a couple times, and there's a lot of steep climbing in that.
Mm.
It's longer and probably a little more rugged. You know, there's slippery downhills and rocky uphills and those kind of things. And a pole gives you a little bit more balance. And particularly in the uphills, it does kind of help save your knees, particularly, you know, hoisting if you're really going up steep. And I think that's one of the things is the European guys are running a little bit steeper terrain. I think, you know, maybe Hard Rock over here is a little bit more like that. Western States, there probably isn't that much really steep terrain to justify, you know, carrying poles the whole way. And they're kind of, we don't allow those at Western States anyway.
Right.
But you know, I think part of the thing is the European guys, there's a lot of European cross-country skiers.
Yeah.
And when you cross-country ski, you get used to using poles. You get really adept at how to manage those. And, you know, I've used poles hiking and running a little bit. I used them at UTMB 1 year. And they're great uphill, and I'm not sure what to do with them on the down yet. There's a little practice required there that I haven't figured out yet. So I think that's what I've seen so far.
I think it saved a few face plants for me on that long run that I did. Just sometimes that half a second gives you just enough time to get that foot where it needs to go so you don't land next with your nose.
Yeah, the difficult stuff, it does give you that balance point.
Yeah, I want to go back to the shorts thing that Tim was talking about. Let's talk about the short length.
Short shorts?
1988, I think they're called duck shorts.
Dolphin shorts.
Yeah. That was before I started running. So I remember one of Don and I, my good friends, we were out camping one time, and he got up at 2 in the morning to go do his run because he was getting ready for Western States. And he came in, and I gave him the worst time in the whole world. These things had a slit up the side. I think I could see everything up the side except for where the band was. I mean, what were the shorts like back then, and how do you think they've evolved?
Yeah, that was pretty much
it. Loincloth. I think it was like a loincloth.
So now you go out there and one of those, everybody looks at you funny because your tan line's all off.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, that was it. I mean, you know, there wasn't the – I mean, you look at – you know, even the companies at the time that I started running, Nike wasn't that prevalent as a running company. They were just getting off the ground. ASICS and Tiger were the kind of the one of the bigger companies at the time.
Tiger.
Yeah.
Boy, I don't remember that one.
They became ASICS, right?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, New Balance was just getting off the ground. And, you know, some of these other companies, you know, there were no Hokas, there were no Ultras, there were no other companies that trail specific stuff that's starting to come out now that, you know, before it was like just take your favorite road shoe and do the best you can with it, right? And then, you know, part of that growth was getting some of these other companies coming into play in the sport and providing some of the tools that you need to be successful.
So over the years, the inseam length kind of dropped down a little bit.
Yeah. I always just thought that was the older you get, the lower the seam went. And it's like now I won't even run with a pair of shorts that don't have pockets in them. Right? So I'm carrying, you know, you get carrying stuff, you get food and stuff in there. You know, you hardly ever go anywhere without having stuff in your pockets.
Yeah, that's important.
So you also mentioned that, you know, people are wearing more compression shorts. Mm-hmm. When did that start all coming around? Did it come from the triathlete world or?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, that they've kind of been doing that a little bit longer than the runner side. But I think that part of that was, you know, some of the science was saying, hey, you know, this might really help you, particularly on the recovery side, right, after the race and keeping blood flow going and helping recovery. But, you know, that was another one of those things where, you know, got going and then everybody's like, whoa, I might as well give it a try. What can it hurt? And, you know, even like say, even some of that short stuff now, I think when you're in an ultra where you're going to be out there for 10, 20 hours or something, that kind of stuff can really kind of keep you more comfortable.
Yeah.
Limit the chafing and support your legs and the whatnot.
Let's talk about long runs because it seems like when I hear, and we're talking 1988, not like 1888 or something. This isn't that long ago. But as we put it into context here, it seems like the running that I heard about, you know, Ann Treason and you guys out there doing stuff, very long runs, lots of miles every week, and back-to-back weekend, a 30 and a, you know, 40-mile run in 1 week. I mean, just a weekend, just a lot of stuff. Am I misremembering or mistold or don't understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think there was. I don't know if it was as long as what people are doing now, just because you have so many more opportunities between events. You know, running a 50-mile or 50K, there's probably 100 times more events than we had 25, 30 years ago. And then, you know, again, back to the thing is, there wasn't that common knowledge of where did the course go or where could I go for a training run. Now there's so many more runners. There's so much more information available through the internet and other events. You go run an event. Hey, I know that trail now. I could go do a 20-miler when I've got a day to go train.
Right.
And I think that's really helped kind of diversify out, you know, the places to train and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, that in our sport, that's kind of the staple of goodness is the long run every week to try to, you know, build your endurance.
Right. Not too far back, it was just you just had your major runs around here. You had, you know, you started off with Way to Cool or Cool Canyon Crawl at the time, and then you another month later you ran AR50, and then you went out to Miwok, and then there was Western States. That was kind of the staples, and there wasn't much more to choose from.
Yeah, there were a few. You know, back in the early days, you had Jed Smith was one of the big fast 50 milers.
Right.
That before the 50K distance became more popular, it was only the 50 miler. That's all there was. Hmm. And you know, there were some really fast guys in that race early on. I mean, there's several people that break 6 hours every time. And that was kind of, you know, it was like Jed Smith. That was Cool came along a little bit later than AR50.
Right.
And then for a while there, Cal 50 was sprinkled in there in Santa Rosa. That was a good one to train. And yeah, but like you say, there was kind of this spring progression of longer distances and runs that you do. And then, of course, when the Western States got their training run weekend on Memorial Day weekend, you went from Miwok to that. And then I'm not saying you're done, but you're close to being done. A couple more runs and you start to taper. So yeah, that's really nice about the spring calendar around here is there's so many events that you can pick and choose from now. There's probably twice as many as those were back then.
So when you said then you're done, which meant that the A race was there, Western States, if that was the goal race out here.
Sure.
And then what happened after that? Because it seems like the running calendar lasts till December, from January to December around here. Did you guys really take off and take a break, or was there still a lot of running going on?
Yeah, I usually did, because I kind of had my training cycle into two rounds. It was like, you know, train for Western States because that was the big event. You know, it was the one you wanted to perform the best at. Then, you know, training around here in June and July and August is pretty difficult. It's pretty hot, you know, 90 or 100 almost every day. I'd kind of shut it down, take some time off Western States, and then start coming back in September for some of those fall races that came along, which, you know, there was Dick Collins, and then for years I did Quad Dipsy, and then CIM, and Sunmart.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like the end of the year sequence, you know, as the weather starts to degrade and you have to find places to go do events because, you know, the East Coast is kind of shut down at that point, and the West Coast, it's getting pretty rainy and goopy. And it's kind of the dead zone of the year for ultra running. And then you take the holidays off, and then January 1, it all starts over again, right?
So do you think that programmed break in your training intensity was a reason that 25 years of spectacular performances could happen, that you didn't break down? Part of it's genetics. Mm-hmm. You won the lottery when it came to things holding together. That's mm-hmm. good. But even good genetics can fall apart if you overuse them.
Yeah, I think it really did. I mean, that's kind of been my goal, you know, kind of after I started, you know, you get in your prime and you're running really well and you mm-hmm. think, you know, wow, this is great. How does it get any better? And then you start slowing down. You start to age, or, you know, yeah. And then, you know, my thought process was, I don't want to ever not be a runner.
Right.
You know, I'm kind of preserving what's left in there. So, uh-huh. you know, there's kind of half life of everything going on. It's slowly diminishing, but, you know, never wanted to get to the point where, you know, couldn't go out and run every week. I mean, yeah. I don't run every day, but, you know, I think a lot of people they get in now and they're going hot and it's really fun, or they're winning some races, and then boom, 5 years later,
yeah,
you know, they're not there anymore.
So speaking of that, let's get to the Sawchuk 7. Do you believe in the Sawchuk 7?
Which is seven yeah. strong racing years. You have seven. That's what a person has in them. And you can divide them up into two and then five. But altogether, collectively, through your career, you're going to have seven strong race years.
I think it might be longer than that. I mean, Ann ran, 14 Western yeah. States and won them all without, you know, too much challenge. You know, I think we kind of had this thing of just a sliding window, depending on what age group you're in. You can kind of compete at the top level, maybe not at the very top for 20 years. If you start when you're 18, you go to your 40. If you, yeah. you see these ladies like Gunhild, she starts when she's 60 or something, and she's right. killing it at 70, right?
Yeah.
Or some people that start when they're 40s and they're doing really well in that age group, right?
Yeah.
It's because, you know, they kind of get into that mold. They're willing to put in the time and improve and, you know, really work at it. But I'm not sure you can do that forever. You know, it gets pretty tiring.
So we have Sawchuk 7 and we have the Tweetmeyer 20. So
Ann and I had that discussion when we were trying to figure out what is that number, right? You know, because yeah. she was at the, you know, probably 15, 20 years. She was yeah. pretty much unbeatable. And, but I think there is a toll that takes place, whether it's totally physical or even psychologically, willing to put in the time and willing to work at it and yeah. really drive.
Right.
I think at a certain point, the gas starts to run low on that.
Let's talk about Ann Trason for a minute. She's not here at this table. She's an amazing, amazing runner, an amazing athlete. And her results through the years have just been untouchable in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Ann Trason as as a runner?
Yeah, I was kind of kidding about this at the lottery 1 year. So, you know, probably she's the toughest competitor I ever raced against, with the guys and the gals.
Yeah.
Because you just knew she was never going to let off the gas. I mean, she would run every hill if it was straight up. You know, she just had one of those things where you just knew she was going to be pouring it on until it was over. And so it was fun to compete with her.
One,
you know, I didn't really
chased,
necessarily have to compete against her, because she's kind of in a different group, right?
Right.
The women and the men are in different categories, but it was fun. We went back and forth for years at Western State. She was second on me at least, I think, a couple of times.
Right.
And but that's, you know, it's, I think there's just some mutual respect there about how, you know, you understand how hard it is to yeah. go and put the time in and race and yeah. compete and everything. That, you know, she had a record that's really, you know, I mean, who was it? Is anybody ever going to win 14?
Yeah,
the men only got half that way. And you know, Scott got the 7.
Right.
And she did 14. So, you know, that's, you know, amazing.
It is amazing. If you go to her ultra sign up page and open it up, get ready to be shocked, because there's a lot of ones yeah. by her name. It's yeah. she, I think, probably the most dominant ultra runner in the history of the sport. She's just, I mean, who's going to touch that for a while?
Yeah, she was way ahead of her time. Yeah.
Let's talk
sure.
about that for a minute. The difference between 1988 and today, and it's probably because there's just more people that are running. But back in the early days, even when I started running, it seemed like the top five male competitors out there were winning almost every race they entered. Mm-hmm. And now you look at the results during a year, and there's not too many elite runners that are winning multiple races during the year. Mm-hmm. They're trading off. I mean, mm-hmm. the top elite athletes, I think there's just more of them out there. You don't see them dominating like you did or mm-hmm. like Ann did back in the day.
Yeah, I think there's a bigger pool of elite runners, and then yeah. you have the sport going a little bit more professional. Uh-huh. So, you know, some of these guys that are on these teams like Hoka and, you know, the different teams that are being sponsored, then they have the opportunity to go to different events that, you know, they're not you know, loading the kids in the car and driving to, you know, the East Coast to go to a race. They're flying on someone else's dime, and they have products to use, and, you know, they're not paying for their shoes or their travel costs. And so I think that that creates a much more competitive high end for sure now than it was maybe 20 years ago, because you have, you know, 15 or 20 athletes that are, you have the opportunity to, I don't want to say make a living at it, but certainly defray all the costs and complexities of travel and competing.
And you could focus on your training more. Mm-hmm. You could sleep, train twice a day, and not have to put in 8 hours at work somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, it's a different dynamic for sure.
Yeah. You know, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to talk about, go back to training for a minute. You know, Tim cycled into Studio G today, mm-hmm. and I want to talk about cross training. Have you seen a difference in our sport? Is cross training increased, decreased, changed? What's your perspective on that?
It seems like all the older runners I see, we're all cycling now. We're getting smarter in our old age. Maybe that's it. You know, I think at the top level, not as much. I mean, still, you know, running's a simple sport. You know, you do more of it, you know, put one foot in front of the other, and that's what you have to do to be good at running. You know, having done cycling and swimming, some triathlon work, you still have to put in the time running. And but I think for the people in the middle of the pack, and those of us who have, you know, opportunities to you know, it's mixed up, I think it's the best way to go. You know, if you want to be an athlete your whole life, you know, and be able to compete, whatever level, at whatever age group you're in your whole life, it gives you that ability to kind of use different muscles, take some days off when you're not just sitting around. And, you know, that goes a long way when you say, hey, I want to be involved in competition for 50 years. Or 40 years, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just go out there and burn it up every day if you're doing the same thing.
You know, do you mind if I do a follow-up on there, Don?
No, I think you should, Scott.
It just hit me as you were talking about that. When you went out on a typical, let's say you're on a 10-day training cycle or something like that, every run that you went out, were you going
full gas.
Or did you back off? Did you fluctuate how fast you ran, intensity?
Well, when I was going good, I had two things that I focused on every week. One was the long run. I used to track. I didn't track mileage so much. I was never a super high mileage guy. You know, if I had 80 or 90 miles, that was a big week. You know, I don't think I ever had a 100-mile training week. But I always tracked how long my long was. It was in ratio to the overall distances that week. So let's say I had an 80-mile week. If I got 40 miles on one day, that was really good. Anytime I had a week where I had 50% of my mileage or more on one run, then I'm probably doing something right. And that gave me, that allowed me to do a lot more zeros. So I might rest the day before a 40-miler, run a 40-miler, take a zero after that. Now I've had two rest days and a hard day.
Yeah.
And so
on that 40-mile, were you going balls to the wall?
Sometimes. I mean, not every time.
Okay.
You know, as I was learning the sport, for me, it was really just time on your feet. You have, you know, when you're a beginner ultra runner, I think it's important just to get out there and experience what it's like to be on your feet and moving for 10, 15, 20 hours at a time. Yeah. You're tuning your muscles, you're training up your metabolism, you're conditioning your brain to how hard it's going to be, and, you know, when you got to, you know, really work hard and when you might want to rest. I think later on, as you become a little bit more tuned to that, then you can go and say, hey, you know, in the middle of this 40-miler, I want to run this next 5 miles at X pace, and, you know, kind of really push it and then shut it down a little after that. So, I mean, it was the long run was definitely, you know, the most important thing I did. The only other thing I did during the week was I always had some kind of a hill workout. I noticed we had talked, somebody in our list was track workouts and that comparatively. And I used to say I never was on a track unless I got lost on the trail run. Somehow I got off the trail.
It was just to do a U-turn to get back on the trail.
Could you tell me where the trail is from here? But, you know, I live really at the top of, you know, one of the steepest hills in Auburn, Cardiac Hill, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things I did when I moved to Auburn, it took me a while to get used to this, but I'd go on Tuesday nights and I'd just take the easiest route down to the bottom and then run, I don't want to say as hard as I can, because it's pretty hard to run that steep of a hill as hard as you can, but from the bottom to the water canal, and measure it, you know, how fast did I go this week and how fast did I go the next week. And
if for people that aren't familiar with that, what is that, a mile and a half? I don't know.
It's about, I want to say somewhere around 700 feet and 3/4 of a mile.
Yeah, okay.
In that range, 600 feet or
feels
700.
Feels like a mile and a half to me.
You know, that just actually reminded.
Feels like a mile and a half. Yeah.
That reminds me, one time, this was probably 2-3 years ago, we had Gordy on, and he was telling about how he would do hill repeats, and he said he would go so hard up the hill that the goal was when he got to the top that he would almost be almost fall over in, mm-hmm. in
ready to vomit. Yeah. I think
or pass out. Yeah. And I thought, man, I don't think I've ever run a hill that hard in my life.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, that's the kind of hill where you just have to really want to keep running. I mean, it's real easy to go, just walk. This is too steep. Just, you know, but you know, part of that is no. Don't walk.
Yeah,
you're going to run. You may be running really slow, but don't walk.
It's a form of speed work, essentially, right? Leg turnover, quick choppy steps.
That was one of them. I had another one that I did out on Sierra College Boulevard, which isn't too far from here, right? And you start at the bottom, and I'd go like, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, and I'd take a rock, and I'd set it on the side of the road. And then the next one, I wanted to move that rock a little farther up the hill. And then a little farther up the hill. And then a little farther up the hill. So every time you had to, you know, want to get a little farther than you did the previous time.
Ooh.
That was a little entertaining.
Well,
at times.
That's before they had GPS watches. You moved the rock. You moved the rock.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, when you think about workouts during the week, we're getting back to that, you know, long runs, definitely big deal. But I think, you know, there isn't really a good trail race that doesn't have some kind of killer hill in it that everybody just, you know, loves to hate.
Sure.
So, you know, that's part of the sport.
Is there anything that you've seen change over the years that you aren't happy with?
Huh. That's a good question.
Besides lotteries.
No one
loves the lottery.
Well, I was telling somebody this whole thing where you have to sign up for every race on January 1st, and it's in September. I mean, you should just roll in with your check and your entry blank at the starting line. Why can't we do that anymore? This whole planning ahead is getting really old.
Yeah.
You know, that's the tough part. It's become popular that, you know, trying to get into the good events or the events that everybody wants to be in is just really, really difficult. That's part of the growth of the sport.
While you're thinking about that, we were just this week running with Bob Crowley, and he gave us some updated statistics. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I usually am. Mm-hmm. He was saying that the sport of ultra running has only grown single digits, like 4 or 5% in the number of people participating. You're laughing because I'm wrong.
I think it was like 0.8%. He had a very
small
number.
Okay, so it's a very it hasn't grown a whole lot year over year. But the number of races increased by like 25%.
Yeah.
So I see that as a very good thing, that there's more races out there.
Yeah, so I live, you know, right off the finish of the American River 50 course and a bunch of other events now that you used to think, oh, in this Auburn State Rec area, which is, you know, a massive recreation area with trails and river crossings and everything. There's several events there, you know, cool, American River 50, Western States finishes there, you know, formidable, and all these other race directors have got new races going on there. The one thing that really drives me crazy, because I run those trails all the time, two things. One is course markings that don't get taken down immediately after the race, and the other is debris on the trail.
Huh.
Yeah.
It just drives me crazy.
Do you think that ultra runners today are less nature friendly than they were in 88?
I just think there's a lot more people out there, and once you get a big enough pool, there's a 5% or a 2% that just kind of wreck it for the rest, and they're just not aware of, you know, what's going on. And you know, one race they figure, well, you know, we'll get our stuff down on Tuesday, or you know, there's cups on the ground. Well, then when you have 10 events out there every month, there's another thing going on.
You know, I'll raise the flag there too. You know, I've been out running out there. There was a race maybe 2 weeks ago that they had marked with I thought it was flour on the trail, and that stuff's still on the trail after all this rain. There's still the markings on the trail, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I think that
I don't know what they used, but whatever they used, it wasn't flour.
We've talked to the state parks guys and say, hey, you know, you have to take like $1,000 deposit, and then like the Tuesday after an event, go out there just random sample the trail and where they had the aid stations. And if there's garbage or debris or trail markings, ribbons in the trees, whatever it is, you know, then keep the money and, you know, invest it in the guys that do the next, have to go inspect the next race and, you know, finance that way. Because you'd say when there was one event a year, two events a year, you know, it was a little more lax. But when there's, you know, an event every other week, then it gets to be a little annoying.
Yeah. Who's the most dominant a trail runner that you've been impressed with, that you was a mentor for you, or that you thought that person is an amazing athlete?
Probably the first person I watched, well, of course, you know, Dick Collins was the guy I learned from. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a front runner, but you learned how to run from Dick and people like Ruth Anderson. I mean,
get to run with him very much?
Yeah, I mean, he was, I mean, if there's anybody that influenced how I compete in the sport, it was Dick and Ruth, watching them the very first time and just realize these guys really know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they're not the most gifted athletes. If you ever watch Dick, you know, he would look like a fullback running. You know, big legs, kind of short and stocky, but he never stopped.
Yeah.
He never stopped. And Ruth had the worst stride. You ever watch her? You're just like, wow, how does she do that? I remember watching her on that track that one time, and she was, I don't know exactly, but she was, you watch her run and you think, oh, she's not going to go 10 miles. And she ended up running like 100 miles at somewhere in the late 40s, 49. This is when women weren't doing a lot of 100-mile running. And she was like 16 hours and something on that track.
Wow.
And you just watch it like, man, if a woman with that stride can go like that, I mean, I can probably get around. Yeah. But, I mean, they're always so happy and, you know, encouraging everyone else and, you know, trying to teach people why they were doing what they were doing and how they were doing. I remember watching Dick at one 24-hour run in Santa Rosa, and right before the run, he goes out and he puts two Dixie cups on the track. I'm like, God, what's he doing, man? And, you know, I'm the pupil here, and I'm watching the scientists mix the stuff. And then the race started, and at a certain point, he just started walking all the curves. And he just realized, you know, if you're going to go around in circles on a track for hours and hours and hours on end, it's the curves that drive your legs nuts because you're turning in such a tight radius. So he'd get to that first cup, and he'd start walking, and get to the second cup, start running.
Really?
Next cup, you start walking, and the first time I did it, yeah, I mean my legs really screwed up because I didn't know that you were supposed to put Dixie cups out on the turn.
I wonder if Zach Bitter had Dixie cups on the track when he broke that record.
Not at an 11:40 finish.
yeah.
I think
he
sprinted between his Dixie cups. That guy's moving. Yeah. You don't always learn all the lessons from the podium finisher. Sometimes they just have an engine that's different than the rest of ours. But the rules of engagement, the Dixie Cup rule or the run walk rule or how to eat or how to pace yourself come from veterans that know how to do it. Yours was Dick Collins and Ruth Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the things that are the same.
Okay.
You know, you talk about you know, walking the hills or whatever. What are some things? You know, the title of the podcast is Back to Basics, right? What are some things that are common threads that we've talked about some of them, but what are some of the things that have come back around 360 is what I'm trying to say. Hmm. Like footwear. Let's talk about footwear. I mean, we've gone all over the board. You started with I think my first half dozen pair were road running shoes. That's what I was told to buy, even though I think there were a few brands out there that we're doing trail runner, and then we've gone to thick soles, we've gone to thin soles, we've gone to barefoot, we've gone to Vibram, you know, and I think we're kind of back to what works, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the footwear thing, so this is really an individual thing, because that's probably, you know, the connection between the ground and the runner. Mm-hmm. There's some communication going on, and it has to be just right.
So here's a great question for you. Yeah. Did you partake in any of the fads? Did you get the
So I never went totally minimal. I'm a fairly big guy for ultra runner, 6'3", 175. So, you know, I'm not wearing the paper-thin racing flats when I run, or my feet would be, you know,
hamburger
look like, you know, chicken scratch now. So I've always kind of been on the cushioning side because, you know, I was kidding one of the manufacturers one time, they don't put any more padding in a shoe that's size 13 for a guy that weighs 190 than a guy who weighs 120 is wearing a size 8.
I never thought
good
about
right?
that.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, I have gone to some of the thicker soled shoes because I think as you get older, right, you know, things aren't quite as adept as they were, you know, 20 years ago. But I think that's great because now, you have that diversity, right? And I think people have started to go back away from the minimal. I think it was a great thing for chiropractors and podiatrists. They probably, the business went way up when the minimal stuff came out for a while there. I think it kind of started, that kind of came in and went really fast. I think that's kind of gone away now. It was just kind of a cool idea for a while, but I think it's kind of calmed down now. But I think on the cushioning side, I think they're still refining that. But, you know, I think just to have that diversity, I think that's why some of those shoe companies have actually been able to last, is that they're providing something that's completely different than what we've seen from the normal big shoe vendors, the Nikes, the Asics, the New Balance have, you know, this wide array of all the stuff that generally is just brand different. It's not, you know, necessarily what I would say technology different, you know, like you say the Ultra, the Zero Drop, you've got Hoka with the extra cushioning, some of these other companies are doing something that's completely different on the wall. It's not just a different color, different brand. It's
right,
you want max cushioning, hey, go talk to the Hoka guy, that's kind of their thing. You want it the Zero Drop, go talk to the Ultra guy. You want, you know, a huge diversity of shoes in that, now you can go to the Nikes and the Asics and the New Balances and Brooks and stuff. So that diversity is great because, you know, everybody out there's a little different, and when you have the different choices, then it's just a matter of going out there and finding what works for you.
Do you put the same number of miles on your shoes before you replace them today as you did back in 88?
I don't count.
Okay.
When they feel really bad, I throw them away.
You know, that's another thing that these watches have is you can you can program in the watch when you started running on a new pair of shoes, and it will. I've never done that.
It'll track it. Another thing the watch will do that we just don't exercise it. Yeah.
It tells time too.
One of the things that Western States has done is a lot of studies, a lot of medical studies, and not every race invests the effort into that. What was the impetus behind that? How did you start, and why did you start, and how does it keep going? Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think the guy who kind of was the anchor point of that for the race was Dr. Lind. You know, he kind of started that and shepherded that along in the early years when it was, you know, him on a scratch pad and just curious about why are these people doing this? And he'd been around with Gordy's first run and, you know, tagged along with the horse ride and then, you know, was the medical overseer for Western States for many, many years. And it just became fascinating. There's very little science involved there at that level.
Yeah.
And to be able to do it in real time with runners that are willing to go 100 miles and run for 30 hours at a pop, you can't do that in the lab. Yeah. It's really hard to get people to do that. So, you know, with Dr. Lind's leadership, it's kind of developed over the years and then kind of became one of the three tenets of Western States, which is, you know, put on a good 100-mile race, do some medical research that benefits not only the event and ultra runners, but all runners or even – you know, just general fitness.
Yeah.
Is running 100 miles really, you know, wrecking you, or is this making you more fit, or both? You know, a little bit of both. And then the last one really around trail preservation and management so that the trail is preserved and taken care of. So that one pillar we trying to continue to go, even though, you know, from an organization that's, you know, that's not the one that's recognized the most, we try to continue to do those studies because we think there's a lot to learn out there. You have quite a laboratory with which to do that with, but we want to make sure when we do that, we don't disrupt the event or any of the runners or anything. We want to be fairly, transparent during the event so we can get the information without disrupting the competition.
Where does a person go to read up or learn? Is there a repository somewhere of this?
It's all out on our website.
Yeah,
Western States 100. Yep.
Yeah, great.
You know, one other quick thing. I know that we're trying to wrap up. We need to get Tim back on his bike.
Yeah.
What about diet? I think that's maybe something that has come around 360 degrees. Back in 88 or even before 88, there wasn't a whole lot of the sports nutrition. It was, you know, you just ate normal, healthy food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got into this big sports craze. People were eating. We were talking to Bob Crowley on our run this week. The power bars came out, and everybody was eating power bars and breaking their teeth off. And hopefully they don't sue us for that. Mm-hmm. And now we've kind of come back to just eating good, wholesome, healthy foods.
Like ice cream sandwiches and Mountain Dew?
Touché.
To go full circle
Touché.
Here.
That's called a callback in the business.
We're back to the basics.
I think that's the perfect wrap right there.
Is the ice cream run on Ultra Sign Up? Can someone sign up?
No. Yes.
By invitation. If you know about it, you're supposed to know about it. If you can't find it, that's
you know
because you're not supposed to know.
We actually talked about that before the podcast. What's the ultra running social media thing that started off with Lazarus Lake?
There was an email list that used to go out.
Ultra list.
Yeah. Were you on the ultra list?
Once in a while. I was just a lurker.
You know, I started a little bit late. But I remember signing up for the Ultra List, and I think it's still going. I don't know how. I should probably look on it again. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what, I finally had to unsubscribe because of just all the emails that were going back and forth. But it's quite entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was trash talk at its finest.
Yeah, we should see if that's still around.
We'll check it out. Tim Tweetmeyer, you know, you talk about legends and mentors. You're definitely one of them. I'm sure that there's a lot of us in this local community that do things unknowingly that, you know, you helped originate or helped exercise.
Trickle down,
right. So I thank you for that, and I appreciate the great example and the stewardship you've had on the trail and going out and do trail maintenance. You're always headed up with a chainsaw in your hand and a sickle.
Do you own a sickle?
We are going back to 88.
1888. But I thank you for all of that, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, honored to have you here. So go out and run.
Mas.
Hey, Andy, wake up. Yeah. You know, you've been passed out for the entire podcast. It's been over an hour.
Get him some coffee.
If that'll help him, pour it down the back of his neck. because we didn't feel it would be fair to speak about this with Andy not around. Well, he's physically in front of us, but he's mentally.
He's unconscious.
He's unconscious. So our conscience is clear.
Now, when we found out we were going to do this podcast with Tim, we decided to add Andy.
Yeah.
And so we asked Tim, is okay if Andy joins us? And he goes, oh, yeah, Jizzle Wizzle. What?
Yeah. What?
I thought Jizzle, that's what his name.
Jizzle Wizzle.
I used to always call him Andy Three Names because he had an extra name. I didn't know why he get an extra one. But then they start, you know, I heard, you know, on the trail. This is all trail stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Jizzle Wizzle.
Yeah. That's what it stood for, is Jizzle Wizzle. Was there any reason that AJW was a Jizzle Wizzle?
I don't have the story behind that.
It sounds like a good rapper name. Jizzle Wizzle. Andy Jizzle Wizzle.
Mm-hmm. Well, AJW, at least on a text, he seemed to allude that he knew what a Jizzle Wizzle meant. So we're going to have to talk to him.
He said I got the impression that there was more meaning behind it.
There's a story.
There's a reason we got to get him in. I need to hear that story.
Yeah. A Jizzle Wizzle. Maybe it was something. Maybe it came at the Michigan Bluff. You guys would camp out there for a week and do a training week. Mm-hmm. It could have been something that happened post-run, late into the night. A Jizzle Wizzle.
A Jizzle Wizzle. So stay tuned so we can find out what A Jizzle Wizzle is.
Hashtag A Jizzle Wizzle.